as photon, go through the airspace between the front of your picture tube, eventually go through the cornea and lens and vitreous humor and aqueous humor of your eye, eventually strike your retina of your eye. The retina has all the right kind of photodetectors that eventually create a signal, a chemical signal, that goes flying down your optical nerve, goes into your brain, into the visual cortex, and eventually gets interpreted into a picture. But it was photons that flew through space that were created by that phosphor that were hit with those high-velocity electrons. You got it. KQKY, KQLAW.
Okay, Vic, did you just describe also what an LED is right now? This is what we're actually looking at as an LED?
Absolutely. The LED uses a slightly different process. It's a kind of laser-like process, light emission by stimulated emission of radiation, on a very much more efficient process than the phosphor process. But the phosphor that's inside of your fluorescent tubes, your cold cathode fluorescent light that's in your display device of your laptop computer, or the compact fluorescent bulbs that are in your house right now, which are eventually going to become light-emitting diodes because they're a lot more efficient and last a lot longer and don't have mercury being dumped into the environment when you dispose of them. You're eventually going to be lighting your house with light-emitting diodes because they're much more efficient. It is a slightly different process, but they are creating photons that come flying out of that LED across the airspace, eventually into your eye, and you say, aha, I can see that. Over to you, Mel.
Okay, now the sun gives off the photons, and that's just part of what we see as the aurora borealis, I assume also, over.
Okay, the sun gives off photons by its process going on near the surface, the photosphere, and there it is pure thermal blackbody emission. In other words, the material on the surface of the sun at the layer you and I call photosphere is a material that at optical frequencies is almost black. But because it is so hot, you can take a black surface, aim a blowtorch at it, make it hot enough, and it will glow dull red, bright red. You make it hot enough, it will eventually be white. Make it hot again, it will be blue. So the peak of the emission of a black surface becomes very bright if you make it hot enough. That's what's going on with the sun. The sun is also issuing a whole lot of what we call solar wind particles, charged particles at a million miles an hour, literally, come flying out of the sun. Some of them hit the Earth's magnetic field, get focused by that magnetic field, and some of them come flying down into the North Polar and South Polar region. And when those particles of the solar wind, focused by our magnetic field, hit the upper atmosphere, by the impact of those particles moving at very fast velocities, striking the air molecules of the upper atmosphere, create local ionization, not too different from that spark of your spark plug, local ionization. You and I look at that ionization, and we call it the aurora borealis. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, this is KQKY. That's what I'm in. I'm going up a very slow process here, how we get back to what we basically know as radio. Now, let's talk about, let's get back really onto the earth. A piece of wire, you started saying what space, what's going on. If we have a really good conductor, this is basically where, you know, a lot of the science is headed for, is trying to make superconductors. If we have a piece of wire that the electrons are free to move, is that, in other words, the more the electrons are free to move, is that basically what we call a good conductor, over?
That's the beginning of the process. What's the difference between copper and ceramic at room temperature? A ceramic material has electrons in the outer orbit of that material, which are filling that outer orbit. It's a very stable outer orbit, and none of those electrons want to leave. They really like being there. And because those electrons have so little tendency to leave, you and I call that an insulator. I can put a voltage across that ceramic material and essentially no current flows. It has a resistivity of 10 to the 10 ohms. I take a piece of copper, and it's got a couple of electrons in its outer orbit that really don't like being there. They want to jump to the next molecule. You put an extremely small voltage across two adjacent molecules of copper that are locked into a copper matrix. It's a solid. They're not free to move. They're molecules of copper. They're locked into this matrix. If you could see it in three dimensions, it would look like a set of monkey bars. And at each one of the junctions of the monkey bars, you've got a copper molecule. And he's locked in space, in that position. He can wiggle around a little bit there, and it's about a wiggle you and I call that temperature. And of the whole darn molecule wiggle. But those electrons that are in the outer orbit, they don't like being there. They like moving somewhere else. So if I put across the copper conductor a voltage, which means between the two molecules that are side by side, the local voltage difference is microvolts. It's something damn small. But those electrons say, aha, I see something I like. That molecule to the right of me is a tiny bit, a microvolt more positive than I am, than this particular molecule I'm at. And I'm a negatively charged electron. I'm attracted to that one, and I'm going to jump there. And when he gets there, the one further to the right is again another microvolt further positive. And you see the process as that electron hops from molecule to molecule rather freely. You and I call that current flow. Because it happens so easily, we call it a very low resistance material. That's not superconducting yet. There is a little bit of tendency of the molecules to hang to their local molecule, the electrons to hang with their local molecule. There's something about the process of superconducting materials at cryogenic temperatures where the electrons of each individual molecule decide to pair themselves up, and they move so freely with no tendency to stay locked to their local molecule, they move so freely that no energy is lost when they hop from the first molecule to the second molecule. I'm making a whole lot of gross simplifications here. But I'm trying to get a vague concept across of what is superconductivity. The molecules move so easily with no energy loss, you and I call that superconductivity. Only happens with certain materials at cryogenic temperatures. I don't completely understand why that is, but I do know to some degree that is what's happening. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY, because I'm going to get a number of emails and all, and I think that's why I was going to try to simplify it down. So we could say a good conductor, a good piece of wire conductor, will have a number of out-of-orbital electrons that are free to move, and we'll say that is a good conductor of electric current. If it has only few... if it only has a few out electrons free to move when the voltage is applied and EMF is applied, we could say that this is a resistance. And if we have no out electrons that are really free to move, we can call this an insulator. Is that basically a good simple breakdown? Over.
You got it. You just went from conductor to semiconductor to insulator in that explanation. An insulator, as I understand it, the outer shell of electrons is usually a complete shell, and they don't want to move. They want to stay right there. Noble gases like neon, argon, helium have an outer layer of electrons that are filling up that particular orbit, and they don't want to move. Each of those noble materials is an extremely good insulator until you put a voltage across them that is so huge that when a cosmic ray comes along, strikes the molecule, and even though those electrons don't want to move, the cosmic ray strikes that molecule of, we'll say, neon, and electron breaks free. And because the voltage field across that cloud of neon is so strong, and you've now got a free electron, that electron gets a chance to get up to such a high velocity that when he strikes the next neon molecule, he breaks at least one more electron and maybe more than one electron free, and he begins the avalanche process. And when that neon gas has enough voltage across it that it finally breaks down, it glows with a nice red color. You and I call it a neon sign. But it takes a huge voltage locally to make that happen. Under normal circumstances, that neon gas is an extremely good insulator. K2KEY, K2LIW.
K2EJK Mobile.
Dusting wire. It's good to dusting wire. In other words, that is why gold is a great wire for the small, tiny circuit, that they use gold because the resistance of the connecting wire is very, very small. In other words, because gold has very low resistance, this is why it's desired in electronic, mini electronic circuits. Correct, over.
K2EJK Mobile.
Ed, recognize we're going to get to you in a second, Ed. Mobile, EJK. Yes, the main reason you use gold is because it's such a noble material that it will not rust, it will not decay, it will not create schmutz locally. It makes very good contact material on the edge connector of a printed circuit board, whereas copper oxidizes, silver oxidizes, all of these things react with the air. Gold is a good conductor, it's not an excellent conductor. Silver and copper are a much better conductor than gold. But we put gold on our contacts in order to have good connection over a period of time. Let's see what Ed wants to ask. K2EJK Mobile, K2LAW, my name is Dick, this is the Technical Man.
Good evening. I'm glad I hit on this technical net. I was just wondering how copy just got into the area. Coming up on exit 9 on the, I guess it's the Cross Island, coming up onto the Frog Neck.
You sound real good, Ed. Go ahead and proceed with your question or comment. My name is Dick.
Dick, pleasure to meet you. You must have internet because you pulled my name right out of the air there. Yes, you are right about the gold being a good connector. The properties which makes it superior is that it does not oxidize. You are right.
Yeah, it's a good conductor, but not an excellent conductor. It makes a good material that I think it's got a pretty high work function, so therefore it's kind of low on multi-factor phenomena in free space as an antenna. And so a lot of antennas, I think, are gold-plated when they go into space. But, there are people who think gold is the best conductor. Not at all. Of all the materials I know of, silver is the best conductor, but only under certain conditions. If you simply electroplate silver on top of copper with the right intermediate material, I think it's a rhodium flash or whatever, or is it a nickel flash? But anyhow, yeah, you don't put gold directly on top of copper. If you do, it'll migrate to the copper and disappear from the surface, and I've seen people make
nickel.
Yeah, nickel. So you put an intermediate layer of nickel. Nickel is compatible with copper. Gold is compatible with nickel. And so when you plate them in that direction, in that order, it works very nicely. Put gold directly on top of copper. And a substantial company on Long Island did that a couple of years ago, brought me in as a consultant saying, what's going on here? Why can't we get good contact with the gold plating? It took a lot of time to convince the chain of command of that major company that if you don't put the nickel layer in between, the gold ain't going to stay there. It migrates. So because it's so noble is the reason you put it there, but it's not the best conductor. And silver, as I was starting to say, only when you put the silver on in just the right process with burnishing and rolling and whatever do you get a good conductivity of silver. You simply electroplate silver on top of your conductor, like copper, even if you've got the right intermediate material. At the microscopic level, the silver that you've electroplated has a whole bunch of little local mountains which don't make contact with each other anywhere near as well as you would like. the process of getting extremely high conductivity silver on the inside of your microwave cavity. That process is an art form. There are very few companies that know how to do that well. You take it to your local silver plating factory that makes silverware that you eat on, and you have him put silver on it, and you'll end up with a much higher resistivity material than the raw copper you started off with. I've been down that road, and it's a very humbling process. K2KEY and the group K2LIW.
WB2.
As Ed number two recognized, but Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, so staying with that. So in other words, if we, you say silver is a great conductor, therein lies that why we take silver and we mix it with lead, and this is solder. So in other words, our solder is a very good, basically a very good material or conductor when we do electronics. Am I correct? Over.
There's a yes and a no to that. Your highest motivation from using silver-bearing solder is because it is a harder material with a higher melting temperature. That's your primary motivation. Your secondary motivation is, yes, it is a higher conductivity than ordinary lead-tin solder, but it's also a lot more expensive. And I'm sure there's a lot more to the story. Mr. Gellinger is going to...
Temperature coefficient.
That's another one. Temperature coefficient, rate of expansion. There's a whole lot of different properties you get when you use silver-bearing solder. Mr. Gellinger is going to straighten this all out on all that. WB2EAV, K2LIW. I bet he's out walking his dog.
All right, first, solder. Silver solder is definitely much harder and stronger than standard tin lead electronic solder. However, the word harder implies it's much harder to use. It's a damn nuisance to use the stuff compared to tin lead. Tin lead is ideally 63% tin, 37% lead. That's the best solder. As far as gold is concerned, the main advantage of gold is that it will not corrode. The ultimate example, even better than the connector pins that Dick was talking about, was in airbags, where you have these little milliamp contacts sitting open for years, decades. Then when they touch, you have to draw the milliamps. You can't have any crud on the contacts, preventing the flow, or the airbag will not inflate. Silver is a very good conductor, and as an aside, high-power switches, and especially high-power relays, always have these big, fat contacts made of, quote, coin silver, unquote, because the arcs you draw, which make and break the contact, actually vaporize any oxide on the surface. Dick?
Beautiful. Every one of the words came through very nicely. Good information, Ed. Thank you. Now, the amazing thing that I've never heard anyone give me a good explanation is that silver is the best conductor we know of. Therefore, common sense would tell me that if I cryogenically cool silver, I should get a superconductor. I do not. If you study the materials that are a superconductor, when they're cryogenically cooled, they are essentially ceramic materials. At room temperature, superconducting materials are some of the world's best insulators. What in the world is going on at the molecular level so that a ceramic insulating material suddenly becomes a superconductor when you cryogenically cool it? I guess not everyone knows exactly what's happening, but because of experimental results, they sort of know how to do it. And the Large Hadron Collider over there in CERN, except for some mechanical errors, is doing a pretty darn good job of it. Anybody got any further explanation on that one? Give me your call letter, K2LAW in the TechNet. Silence is deafening. It's a tough one. So, what we've learned tonight is that gold makes very nice, reliable contacts for relays, the contacts on your airbag, which has to be reliable, otherwise your life's not going to be saved as well during that accident if that airbag doesn't go off and stop that steering wheel from stabbing itself into your chest and stop your head from striking the windshield. if you've ever kicked field with your foot, you realize that Arnold Schwarzenegger, in his high-strength days, might not have been able to kick a hole in a windshield of an automobile. Yet during an accident, your head goes through that windshield. The instantaneous forces during that event must be horrible. And how the cranium of a head can survive that is just amazing to me. And thankfulness, airbags and seatbelts and whatever protect you, because the thing that an awful lot of the people don't realize, and there's a significant number of people out there saying, I don't want the government controlling my life. I'm not going to wear that seatbelt. And if the policeman catches you doing that, he gives you a ticket, because you're going to increase our insurance rates if you keep living that way. People don't realize that every accident consists of two accidents. The first accident, your automobile strikes a solid object of some kind and starts decelerating very rapidly. You, if you're untied down, are inside that automobile still moving forward at 60 miles an hour. The second accident is when you, a 60 mile an hour projectile, strike the innards of your automobile. Steering wheel goes through your chest, knee goes ramming into the instrument panel, and head goes through the windshield. That's if you stay in the car. And if you leave the automobile, by whatever means, and the automobile rolls over you, I don't have to describe how unhappy you're going to be. And a hell of a lot of people die because they refuse to wear a seatbelt. Foolishness. Okay. You've got to understand the physics of all this. I know I'm off to one side of one of my hobby horses. Anybody got any further comments on all of the above, give me a call at K2RIW. Again, dead silence. One of the things we've covered tonight that is very well kept secret, what is temperature? Velocity of the molecule. Average kinetic energy due to velocity. If it's a solid material, they're shaking in place. If it's a gaseous material, the individual molecules are flying around. Those molecules of air, in general, never, never touch each other, never touch any other object. That meteor that strikes the atmosphere at 150,000 miles an hour gets hot and burns up because of compression of those air molecules at the leading edge of the meteorite. It's not because of friction. The air molecules do not rub against the meteorite, a meteor, per se. It's compression. The leading edge of a high-flying rapidly flying airplane, gets hot because of compression. The bottom of your bicycle pump gets hot because of compression. The moving wall of that particular cylinder, moving toward the air molecules that were in their normal velocity going to strike that wall, like the ping pong paddle, when your ping pong paddle is moving toward the ball and the ball strikes the paddle, after the bounce, the ball is moving more rapidly because you were moving the paddle toward the ball. If the paddle was sitting still, you still get a bounce, but nowhere near as much velocity after the bounce. So it is the moving wall of the bottom of your bicycle pump that increases the velocity of those air molecules, and we call that higher temperature. And by the beautiful equation we've all heard in high school and college, PV equals NRT, you take a given volume, a given mass of air molecules in a container, and in an adiabatic manner, in other words, without draining heat out or adding heat to them, you simply compress the air molecules by decreasing the volume of the chamber. Because you had to move the wall of the chamber to do that, you've increased the velocity of the air molecule, and we call that a hotter substance. How many of you guys have heard any of that jazz before in the way that you understood it? It wasn't explained to me that way. I didn't get it until relatively recently. And air breaks down because the individual electrons that have been freed by a cosmic ray get a chance to build up enough velocity, because you've got enough local voltage, that when that free electron strikes the next air molecule, he's got enough velocity to ionize, break apart that next air molecule, to disassociate the electron from the nucleus, and he starts the avalanche process, and you and I called it an arc, and your spark plug is doing it every day, and it moves your automobile. And I was recently doing some high voltage experiments in which I was moving contacts with roughly 100,000 volts between them, closer and further apart and watching the arcing of the air. Fun process to watch. And when you see it, you'll recognize the fact that every arc that's more than, I'll say, a quarter of an inch long, in air, at standard temperature and pressure, every arc is a zigzag. Every lightning bolt is a zigzag. And why are they a zigzag? There's a beautiful explanation of that. We'll get into it someday. I'm going to pass it around to you guys for any questions or comments on that before Bell opens up his mailbag. K2KEY and K2LIW, we're listening. This is the Technical Net on Live Arc. Okay, I think that was Mr. Gellender, and you're going to have to find a better location and try again. I can just barely recognize your voice. I didn't hear any of the words. I'm listening on the input and the output. Unfortunately, the Suffolk County transmitter that's stuck on happens to be only a small number of miles from my house. Over to you, Ed. Give it another try. Okay, Ed. Sorry to say, Ed, we did not get that. Want to try another location? And the confusing thing here, Ed, is that when you move around for the best reception at 8.5, it's not necessarily the best reception at 2.5. There's two separate picket fencing going on. So choose another location, give us another short blast, and we'll find out if we're going to hear you. If that was you, Ed, that's the worst location. Try another. He said, oi, and crazy, and we heard half of the syllable. You were moving at the time, so you haven't chosen a good, steady location yet.
Here's where I was coming through.
Now you're making it beautifully. Go ahead and repeat your message.
It wasn't worth it for this. The reason that electric arcs make a zigzag is to justify the way they've been in comic books all these years.
Okay, I'll accept that. There's a more scientific answer. I'm going to hold that one for next week. Bell, maybe it's time you open the mailbag so that we don't get any more unhappy people. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Is this working this way? Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're working. It's working quite well. Who are you? Is this Ed? Okay, somebody said, is this working this way? The answer is yes. Want to go ahead and ask your question?
K2EJK Mobile.
Mr. EJK Mobile, you sound very good. You're right ahead.
From what I remember in classes many, many years ago is that the reason why lightning takes a zigzag is that lightning will take the path of least resistance in the air, the molecular structure of the air, where it's thinner. That's what the strike will proceed to go through.
Good sounding explanation. Much too simplistic. Macroscopically looking, speaking, that mass of air between the cloud and the ground is extremely uniform. The shortest path with the least resistance is going to be a straight line. No lightning bolt is a straight line, for a very good reason. Back to you, Ed. Okay, I'm going to leave that as an exercise for the student. We're going to discuss that next week. K2KEY, go ahead, Mel. K2LIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Very good, Dick. Yeah, I know. We'll get into all this micro business and all this. It gets a little bit complicated, a lot more to it. And I know that we're going to get some questions and comments about it, but well, I think it's very interesting overall that we do discuss once in a while, but you know, really dig into the nitty-gritty of what really we are calling, you know, our radios and what they're doing, really, other than just, you know, talking on it. And so we'll continue this, like you say. I'm just looking through here. Hey, oh, you know, I have, let me see if I still got it. Yeah, okay. That's what makes me problems here. You know, I'm curious, how come this repeater didn't time out all the time over
I shut it off.
Because KE2EJ turned off the timer because we haven't yet gotten control of that transmitter in Suffolk County that somebody has stuck on by mistake. Go ahead.
Boy, okay, you should be able to be able to found these. You know, it's been on there long enough. I can't imagine that, why it's on, what's going on there. And maybe it should be really looked for, but maybe somebody is in some kind of a trouble and they just locked the mic on hoping that they'll be found, Dick. Over.
I doubt it. It's been on since 5:30 this afternoon, continuously, or 5 o'clock this afternoon. I've seen one of these situations once before that we ran into in the Lockfield repeater, 147.21. Somebody had a chunk of electronics that was supposed to automatically turn the transmitter on and off. It went into a failure mode while he was at work, and the transmitter went on continuously until he came home. And I had done that particular bunny hunting. I found his particular transmitter at his location, talked to his landlord, told him nothing serious, not to worry, but when he comes home, please tell him he's been on the air all afternoon, and he might have to change his electronics a little bit. I think it's one of those situations. Mel, go ahead.
Okay, the only reason I brought that up is because there was a post on the news yesterday. There was a poor guy that was laying on the floor in his apartment for 8 hours, and it wasn't until a neighbor's dog came up to the door and detected him in trouble and refused to move from the door, and was the dog was actually howling, this little dog, because he sensed something wrong. So that's why I said that maybe somebody is in some kind of problem, you know, and using his rig to try to summon help. Over.
Yeah, but if he's got the ability to turn on the rig, he would send some kind of SOS or dot 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 or whatever. Possible, yes, but I don't think so. I think it's a somebody put a pillow on top of a push to talk switch, or the mic fell between the seats of a car and got turned on. One of those kind of deals is what I think is going on. Mel, go ahead.
Okay, must be a good rig to be keyed down all these hours. I'm burnt out. Okay, very good. One of the questions I have gotten quite a number of in different forms is young people or new hams asking, I'd like to do some HFPW. I live in an apartment, which seems to be quite a number of the hams, of course, in the urban areas here. What kind of antennas? What can you tell me about what I could think of as an antenna when I know I can't put anything up on the roof? What can you give some suggestions that possibly will work? You know, I was going to delve into this a number of times with the magazine, because I just brings up a very interesting point, Dick. Over.
WB2EAB has a comment.
K2EJK has a comment.
Okay. Ed number two and Ed number one in that order. Mr. Gellander first. Stay right where you are and go ahead, Ed.
I'm not moving. Okay, I used to live in an apartment when I was a teenager and got my ham license. And I had three windows in a row. Luckily, my bedroom was the middle of the three windows. And I was able to run a 15-meter dipole from window to window. And I put little banana jacks on the ends so I could hang down another couple of feet of wire on each end to work 20 meters. Worked the world with that. However, these days, the sunspot cycle the way it is, you can't count on 15 and 20. And I never figured out how to go on 40 under those circumstances. Did you copy, Dick? WB2EAV.
100% copy. Too bad you couldn't get to 40. I guess you weren't on a high enough floor of the building where you could hang the radios down far enough to resonate the antenna on 40. And in those days, we didn't really know about antenna tuners. That 15-meter or 20-meter antenna of yours, with the right kind of antenna tuner, would have had 95% efficiency on 40 meters. That's my belief. What do you think, Ed? Go ahead.
I moved. This okay?
You sound good. Go ahead.
All right. First of all, option of running a long wire, I was on the 13th floor, and yes, the building did have 13th floor. The option of running a long wire down was discussed but rejected for, shall we say, political reasons. I really question whether an inexpensive antenna tuner would really load up a 15-meter dipole on 40. I really think you're pushing a boulder uphill too far. You need a pretty impressive antenna tuner to get away with that.
Au contraire. You're talking now about a 3-to-1 frequency range. Yes, C720. 3-to-1 frequency range. If I build a dipole at 1/3 of its normal length, Chapter 4 of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, graph number 4-3 and 4-4 will tell me that my resistive component went from 70 ohms down to about 15 ohms. I'm not sure of the exact number, but in that neighborhood. My reactive component went from 0 to about 800 ohms. So, can I build an antenna tuner that matches 15 ohms of resistance and 800 ohms of reactance? Nowadays, a man named Dillinger could do that in a heartbeat. I'll admit that when you were a neophyte, you and I were neophyte novices in those days. No, we didn't know how to do that. With the materials you have in your shop right now, you could definitely do that with 95% efficiency. You tell this to the average amateur, that an infinitesimal dipole can still have near 100% efficiency as long as you properly impedance match it. You tell that to the average guy at 20 meters, he'll think you're crazy. You open up the book called Antennas by Kraus, and you read the chapter on the infinitesimal dipole, and then you read the Antenna Engineering Handbook, Chapter 4, put them two together, and you'll become a believer. Back to you, Mr. Gallander.
First of all, Kraus will tell you how a Yagi works, as we discussed a few months ago. Secondly, are you working your way up to designing the base-loaded coupling?
I assume that your antenna was a dipole. I assume that your dipole, with or without the banana plug, could operate on 15 or 20 meters. If you fed the center of that dipole in the normal location, but put an impedance-matching device that accepted the fact that the dipole was no longer 70 ohms, but it's now 15 ohms resistance, in 800 ohms of reactance, by the way, capacitor reactance, as long as you impedance match to that, and believe it or not, there are some of the old-fashioned PI networks where the C1 and C2 capacitor had enough range that it might make it, particularly with the right length of coax cable between the antenna and the transmitter. I guarantee you could have made that antenna work. I'll admit it would be narrowband as all hell. Every time you QSY more than 10 kilohertz on 40 meters, you're going to have to readjust those controls. But I know you can make it work. All you have to do is resonate it. Once you resonate it, you can do a beautiful job of radiating. You got it, Ed.
K2 EJK Mobile.
EJK Mobile, in a second. Go ahead, Mr. Gallander.
No, I'll wait. Go
ahead. Ed, are you still there? EAV?
Yeah, let him go.
Okay, Mr. EJK, you got it, Ed number one.
Okay, I'm going to say 73 because I'm at 1 QTH, which was kind of on plan stop, so I'll be back on the net about a little bit. K2 EJK Mobile.
Okay, we'll hold your place. And I'm not sure, but was Eric also going to make some comment on this? I guess not. So, with that in mind, there's a zillion ways you can string a dipole between the windows of an apartment building, locate the dipole within the apartment itself by stringing it across the ceiling, zigzagging it. All you have to do is have a length of wire that has a broadside, vaguely broadside in the direction you want to transmit. In other words, if you want to transmit to your buddies in England, and England by Great Circle Pass between here is roughly to the northeast, so if I string a chunk of wire across the ceiling of my apartment that goes at right angles to that direction and zigzag it and do whatever I've got to do to resonate it, I'm on the air. It's not perfect, And if you're a little bit unlucky, you might have some television interference because it's a pretty potent antenna, not too far away from the neighbor's television set. But indoor antennas, particularly if you've got a high apartment building, can work quite well. It may not be the ideal way to do it. And yeah, making mobile equipment and going out to a nearest park and with a slingshot, shooting a lead weight up into the tree and swinging an antenna and operating from the picnic table in the park, that's a beautiful way of doing it. But if you want to do it from your home, with craftiness, there's about 10 or 20 ways it can be done, in my opinion. And I bet you you've done some of those things, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, Roger, this is K2KEY. Yeah, I had the situation of living in the city at one time. And most of my operating was mobile, but I used to take the rig into the apartment. I only had a studio apartment there. And I used to take the mobile with, actually stick it out the window on a bracket I made up. I closed the window down and held it in place. I had actually put under the carpet my counterpoise, which was actually this copper flashing material that comes in a roll that's used by roofers. And I actually laid that underneath the carpet. It was actually a scatter rug, and I just laid it out, put the carpet down very, very flat on top of it. And that was my counterpoise. And when I used the rig, my ground, actually I used just a big alligator, just a, one of these, not an alligator clip, it's a, these clamps, these clips that they used to use, like battery clips, actually the white clip, the white copper clip. I used to clip that onto the faucet in the kitchen. So that was my basic setup, Dick, over.
You got it. Because the materials that go into an HF antenna, a simple dipole-like HF antenna, in general are not expensive. A piece of 14-gauge household wire, a piece of coax cable, maybe a loading coil, maybe a matching capacitor, maybe a clip lead. The materials are not expensive. And the average amateur is a little bit crafty, is willing to do some experimenting. Who cares if the first two antennas you build inside the apartment do not work? Doesn't matter. You're not going to be penalized for that. Keep fiddling. Keep experimenting. There's a large number of ways that you can build stealthy antennas inside of an apartment, inside of the flagpole, in front of the building, hanging down the side of the building, as a kind of a television aerial on the roof. There's a zillion ways it can be done. Hidden alongside of the parapet of the roof of the building. So just keep experimenting. Who cares if the first one doesn't work? Most modern day rigs have got built-in protection circuit from high standing wave ratio. The rig's not going to explode. The antenna's not going to catch on fire. And nothing bad's going to happen as long as you use some common sense. Be careful about putting the conducting circuits of the antenna near any kind of power wiring. Definitely avoid that. Don't even think about radiating the signal into the Con Ed wiring. Don't even consider that. Much too dangerous. Make sure wherever you lay the wire, it doesn't come close to any of the transmission or distribution wiring of Con Ed or LIPA or New Jersey Power and Light or any of these others. Avoid that. And try to avoid making it too obvious as far as the landlord is concerned. And maybe you have to do certain things aesthetically to keep the wife happy so the antenna is not too ugly inside the apartment. But most of the crafty hands have found a large number of ways of stringing antennas inside and outside of an apartment in ways that sometimes don't show. Sometimes they've done it with 30-gauge wire that nobody can see, and it's strung from the window of the apartment to a tree some distance away. 30-gauge wire with button insulators on the end. Nobody sees it, and it's a real stealthy antenna. And the antenna doesn't have to be fed from the center. You can feed it from one side. You don't even have to have a piece of coax cable hanging out in there in the air feeding the center of this antenna. There's lots of ways of doing it. Just keep trying. Don't give up. K2KEY, K2RIW.
And Roger, this is K2KEY. Well, the problem is, in order to be QST, CQ, a number of these magazines, you know, they know that most of the hams today live in an urban area. I would say the vast majority of hams, and maybe a very, very small percentage of them, have property and the resources to put up a tower and all. So, and I think what they should be doing, that's just what I was bringing up to, I'd like to bring up to a number of these different magazines, that they should be featuring more and more situations like this, you know, what can be done to encourage people to try, you know, to work HF radio, CW, from the urban area, and with the restrictions, of course, most of the condominiums and all do not permit you to go up on a roof and all, in any which way, some kind of answers to these questions. But they once in a while will touch upon, you know, a compromise, some kind of compromising antenna for people living in the city. But, you know, seldom really more than somebody's basic ideas that I'm sure there's a lot of mail they must get, but for some reason they like to feature these beautiful towers with huge arrays, big piece of property on their front covers. You don't ever see anybody really operating from a small apartment and with, you know, these types of circumstances, Dick, over.
Yeah, and I think I know what's going on here. You sell the magazine because it's got attractive pictures and some of these beautiful antennas that people have set up, where it's taken them half a lifetime to get the resources to do it. The right piece of land, the right money, the right research, and build, you know, an antenna that we can all dream about. A heavenly antenna farm in the backyard. Those pictures are attractive and they sell magazines. The simplistic antennas you and I are talking about are not that attractive. And a high percentage of the subscribers of the magazine have been in ham radio for 15 years. They completely forget about what it was like in the beginning. They completely forget about what a beginner needs for information to get started in this hobby. There are a couple of good books you can buy on the subject of so-called stealthy antennas, urban antennas, invisible antennas. If you just Google word combinations like that, you will find free articles that will show you how to do this. You're not going to find very many of them in QST, Ham Radio, CQ73. Ham Radio doesn't exist anymore in magazine, but you know what I mean. Not going to find very many of those. But you Google those words. Guaranteed there are websites where people have written articles showing you how to do it. KQKEY, KQLIW. Go ahead, Ed.
I never did write off my famous Ben coat hanger mobile antenna. Maybe I should have.
You definitely should have. And for a guy who wants 2-meter mobile operation with an inexpensive antenna from his car, that Ben coat hanger antenna is a goodie. If you go to WA5BJV.com, Whiskey Alpha 5 Victor Juliet Bravo.com, that's Kent Britton's website, where he sells printed circuit antennas. But you go through various pages of his website, you will find a coat hanger Yagi for 2 meters. By using pieces of coat hanger on a piece of wooden boom that's made out of a piece of wooden molding material, you can make a 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 element 2-meter Yagi that on that band will give you a whole lot of gain for a dollar's worth of material, so to speak. And I guarantee there are a bunch of other websites that will show you how to build high-frequency antennas, 80 through 10 meters. And that's what these guys are asking in Mel's mail right now. They're not looking for 2-meter antennas, per se, although there's ways of doing that on 2 meters, too. Some of the best 2-meter antennas are kind of expensive. You can build antennas of almost equal performance for a couple of dollars worth of materials if you're crafty enough and you find the right construction article. KQKEY, KQRIW.
Hey, this is KQKEY. Yes, definitely. But you see, we're talking about now, we're getting jumping to VHF and UHF, getting to be able to operate on HF does present a little bit different, you know, problems than just a coat hanger situation. And the, like you say, there are some articles, some books maybe that may be available. But, you know, if they would put in these magazines pictures, actual pictures, you know, and real descriptions from people that had the experience, direct experience of doing this, I think it would be, you know, really a service to a lot of hams that, well, I can tell you, there's a number of them have, you know, gotten into ham radio, went to this, you know, situation and could only get on VHF, UHF, and sort of their interest tapered off because they didn't have, you know, the facilities to be able to get on something, do something else. And I think, you know, like they said, if they maybe would have had some way of getting on HF radio, it would have maybe given them another challenge or another interest in ham radio to, you know, to pursue it, Dick, over.
Yep. There's a definite need for articles on what you're describing, because 95% of the readership of the popular magazines, ham radio magazines, have been in the hobby for, let me pick a number, 10 years. And they're looking at for antennas that are popular among those oldsters, guys who've been around a while, and they're trying to trade up. It's like a guy who buys a small rowboat in the beginning, and he gets them, and he slowly buys bigger and bigger boats where he can take more and more people out on his party boat. Well, we amateurs climb the ladder of bigger and better antennas, and so the majority of the readership wants the better antenna. We're going to buy the magazines with those pictures. We've all forgotten about what the beginning was like. So there's very few magazines that are going to have a significant number of articles on simple beginner antennas. There's a need for that, but the need is the minority of the readership. And it's the beginning readership that doesn't have a lot of resources yet, and they're not going to buy a lot of magazines, so they're not motivated to put in those articles. But there are websites. There are crafty amateurs out there who found various ways of very inexpensively making antennas for very difficult environments. And their way of bragging about it is to create a website. And if you Google the right combination of words, you will find those articles. 6 months or 3 months ago, I wanted to find dipole broadbanding technique, and I Googled those words. I found a large number of articles on very inexpensive antennas that have various doodads hanging on them to make the dipole more broadband. If you get a hold of the ARRL antenna book, the manual on antennas from ARRL, there are a number of simple, easy-to-reproduce antennas there. And some of them can definitely be adapted to apartment living. So don't give up. The research is there. I mean, the material is there if you do some digging. And once you accept the fact that the antenna is not expensive, it just takes craftiness and a little bit of tinkering, there's a large number of ways you can put an antenna in your particular environment, with almost without exception, no matter what the supervisor of the building says. There are ways of getting antennas in that building that the super will not object to. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. Well, you're, like you say, you got to go to a self-antenna system, then they go to spot it, and they are very, very strict in a number of these places now. And, well, yeah, I guess you got to be very careful, because it could be a lot of problems if they do spot the antenna. So this, I must say that you have to use extreme caution, because, you know, that it can't fall or whatever, you know, it doesn't present any hazard. So, all right, what can I say? This is the best I can. I know I've gotten a number of these emails, and I can't really give, you know, a simple formula for everybody. Each person's situation is different. And I got to guess, too bad it's not, you know, covered more thoroughly. Okay, let me take a look. I got something else here very interesting to take over.
Calling to RSO with a suggestion.
Mr. RSO, I think that's, I should know he's Bernie. I think it's... No.
It's Frank.
Go ahead, Frank.
Okay, then. I believe there are a number of manufacturers out there that make antennas that are either specifically for apartment dwellers or mobile antennas that can be modified and used in an apartment and sell an antenna. If the gentleman who posed the original question is willing to spend a few dollars, an example would be a mobile antenna such as the Hustler. Right now, the only bands that he can sell 40, 75, and 80, and 160. So if you bought a couple of resonators for the Hustler and mounted it on his window at a 45-degree angle, you should be able to get pretty good results. And with a good antenna tuner, such as the new LDG automatic tuners, or even an MFJ, inexpensive tuner, you should be able to make work more than one band on the antenna. MFJ, by the way, also sells, I believe they call it an apartment dweller's antenna, which is basically a whip with interchangeable loading coils, and you should be able to work the world with that. Back to net in 2 hours, though.
So I think you're recommending, Frank, that he start off with a mobile antenna and create a kind of a counterpoise similar to the automobile and use the mobile antenna from the apartment is what I think you're suggesting, or maybe hang it out the window at nighttime and bring it back in so the super doesn't see it the next morning. Is that sort of what you're recommending, Frank? Go ahead.
Yeah, pretty much, Dick, but some of these antennas that use very thin whip can be mounted, probably left there all day if you sit a number of stories above ground. No one will notice it. And if they do start to noticing it, if the whip is at a 45-degree angle, just put a small flag on it and show you patriotism.
KC2EFR. KC2EFR, go right ahead with your comments. Start over with your name, sir.
Name here is Mitchell, in an apartment in Manhattan, and I have a fair amount of experience with window antennas for HF. That MFJ whip with the block